Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at this perilous interregnum we're in between a lame duck president with no credibility and a president-elect with no authority as the economy is in free fall. We'll be speaking with Dr. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he's also a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. His most recent book is the award-winning intellectual biography of the late economist John Kenneth Galbraith, entitled John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, and His Economics. Dr. Parker is the co-founder of Mother Jones, the former managing editor of Ramparts, and currently serves on the editorial board of The Nation. He's also was also a political advisor to presidential candidate George McGovern and Senators Edward Kennedy and John Glenn, among others. Last Wednesday, Richard Parker chaired a forum at Harvard's Institute of Politics with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, entitled Financial Re-regulation, the Economics and the Politics. And we were talking about Dr. Parker's idea of a new deal and address this, as I mentioned, this perilous interregnum we're in. And then we'll talk about piracy on the high seas and the country that hosts them with Dr. Saeed Sheikh Samatar, who's professor of African history at Rutgers University, the editor-in-chief of the independent journal Horn of Africa. He's published about 40 articles and 6 books on Somalia, including Somalia, a Nation in Turmoil. And he's currently working on a project titled The Somali Collapse, Its Causes, Consequences, and Context. And then we'll speak about the closely watched Senate race in Georgia, where there's a possibility that the Democrats may reach 60 seats in the Senate, giving them a filibuster-proof margin. We're speaking with Dr. William Boone, a political science professor and dean of graduate studies at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia, a recognized expert on Georgian politics, and of course there'll be a special senatorial election for this seat on December the 2nd between Saxby Chambliss, the incumbent, and Jim Martin. So we'll look into that race. Let me begin now with Dr. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he's also the senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center, Oxford-trained macroeconomist. His writings have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, the LA Times, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune. His most recent book is the award-winning intellectual biography of the late economist John Kenneth Galbraith, entitled John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. And Dr. Parker is the co-founder of Mother Jones, the former managing editor of Ramparts, and currently serves on the editorial board of The Nation. He's also been a political advisor to presidential candidate George McGovern and Senators Edward Kennedy and John Glenn, among others. Last Wednesday, Richard Parker chaired a forum at Harvard's Institute for Politics with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, entitled Financial Re-regulation, Economics and the Politics. And it does seem, Dr. Parker, that we're in a perilous interregnum here between a lame duck president with no credibility and a president-elect with no authority, as the economy appears to be in a free fall. Do you think there's any way that somebody can start minding the store?
Well, I mean, I think that people are not paying attention to who Tim Geithner is. He's not just the Treasury Secretary designate, but he's the head of the New York Federal Reserve, and he is minding the store as we speak. And I think that that probably was a tipping factor toward Geithner over Summers, who, as you know, has now been named to the National Economic Council.
And he's expected to be in the White House shepherding this new deal, I guess, that's what you call it, is what President-elect Obama said on Saturday's radio address. Does that adequately sketch out what he's planning on doing?
No, I don't think it adequately sketches out, but it plays something of the role of the Commonwealth Club speech that was given by Roosevelt late in the campaign of 1932, where it's laying out broad principles and making specific claims. I think there's a lot more to be laid out, and I think this is going to be a work in progress. It's going to be a work in progress for a couple of reasons, one of which is that actual conditions on the ground today are not those that were on the ground in 1932. Literally by then, we were hitting the first nadir of the of the Great Depression. The fall from 1929 had been such that 90% of the stock market value had been wiped out, something like a quarter, and probably more accurately, a third of the workforce was unemployed, housing values were in free fall, and because there were no federal safety nets of any kind, of deposits, of unemployment insurance, of Medicare or Medicaid or the like, the terror which struck people because literally disaster and starvation were at hand in the 1930s are not the same today. We're all very frightened, but the risk of the kind of material suffering that our grandparents' generation went through is not the same. Now, the second factor is that this is a moving machine with a lot of moving parts. Even with Geithner there at the Fed, he is independent but working with a Republican Secretary of the Treasury and a lame duck Republican administration, and is facing a lame duck Congress with a Republican minority and a blue dog bunch of Democrats who are very differently inclined than this incoming president and this incoming Democratic majority that will show up in January. So that's factor number two. Factor number three is we don't know what's going to fall next, but there are things that are going to fall next. That is, there are pieces of the global financial structure that don't look like a gargantuan disaster only because we're not staring at them. So should any of those tip over and go public, then I think that we're going to be in much worse shape on the financial front. And then finally, on that third point, sort of a 3B, we're entering a big, stiff, and global recession. And I think that everybody, every macroeconomist I know is worried not about whether we're in recession, but just how long this thing is going to last and exactly how we're going to work our way out of it. And I'd be glad to talk about that more in a moment.
But let's assume or speculate, Dr. Richard Parker, that on we know what happened with the Lehman Brothers and how, and I think most people recognize now that that was letting Lehman Brothers go under had a devastating effect on the global economy, and we're still reverberating from. What happens next week, for example, if the Citigroup, which is $65 billion in debt and apparently hanging by a thread, if it goes under, because, again, it's hard to know who's going to jump in and take charge here, that won't that have similar repercussions? And then you'll have to go through another whole bailout mechanism till the point where the cupboard is bare.
If I were a betting man, I would not bet that Citi is going to be allowed to go under by the Fed or by the Treasury. They also understand what happened in the wake of Lehman, and they also understand what the political repercussions as well as the economic repercussions are going to be if Citi slips away. What they may do is force a quick sell-off of assets and then a fire house sale of the remaining core asset of Citi. But I don't personally, and the people I talk to, don't believe that Citi, as it's currently constituted as a whole, is going to be allowed to go into Chapter 11.
And who's going to make that decision not to let this happen?
People at the highest levels of government and on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. And is there any coordination here or any sense of,
these people have been talking to each other since the fall of Bear Stearns. It isn't a question of coordination. Everybody's in touch with one another. In fact, these poor guys really are not off their cell phones for more than about 20 minutes at a time. I don't know that many of them have been getting much more than an average 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night there. In so much contact. That's not the question. I mean, the Fed and the Treasury were trying to force a deal 2 months ago with Citi to have B of A take them over. And so Citi and B of A's CEOs did, at the instigation of the federal authorities, talk to one another, but nothing came of it at that time. So have no fear about either the conversation is going on or that it's going on constantly. It is. It's just a question of how this thing is going to be put together. There's a certain amount of liar's poker that goes on in these things. If you remember Michael Lewis's wonderful description of Solomon Brothers in the 80s, And like the automobile bailout, each side is playing a certain bluff with his hand to try to get the best possible terms from whatever the end game of this card game is.
So some of the press reports that we get then, that Secretary Paulson is sort of out to lunch, he's thrown up his hands. We don't know what happened to the half of the $700 billion that has already been allocated. He says, no, I'm leaving the other $350 billion for the incoming president, and none of that can go to bail out Detroit, et cetera. So is that exaggerated, that one, the money, the $350 billion went into a black hole, and two, that Paulson seems to have thrown up his hands?
I haven't talked to Hank Paulson recently, but it's a curiosity that Bob Reich, Hank Paulson, and I all went to college together, all graduated in the same class, and certainly knew one another quite well. And Hank Paulson was a starting tackle on an Ivy League football team that won the Ivy League championship not once but 4 years in a row. So I don't see Hank Paulson as the type of guy to throw up his hands. He is a very physical, very in-your-face, very tough guy. And, you know, the fact that he knelt before Nancy Pelosi in order to push this bailout deal through originally, if you'll remember, is about as close to throwing up his hands as I can imagine. No, he's still pushing.
And what about the notion that there's no transparency in what's happened so far?
There is no transparency because they don't want transparency. There are two reasons for not wanting transparency. They don't want to be second-guessed by the press and the Democrats. And I'm not endorsing this. I'm just, you're asking me a question, why not what should be. So the first is, they don't want transparency because they don't want to be second-guessed. Second, they don't want transparency because they know the market actors are habituated to opacity and are fearful of transparency. Let me give you a perfectly good example. In the wake of Enron's collapse, the government put in place something called the mark-to-market rule, which is if you're holding an asset whose market value changes, you can't continue to list that asset on your books at a purchase price or any other price other than what the current market price is. This was the beginning of the end of Bear Stearns, and was also how Bear Stearns briefly stayed alive. That is, the mark-to-market rule in Bear Stearns' case, when its hedge fund started to collapse, meant that its overall asset value was going down, down, down. If it was going to stay alive, it needed to borrow money, and the Fed was not lending, and there was no Treasury fund at that point. So it had to turn to banks like Citi and J.P. Morgan for funds. And initially, Citi and J.P. Morgan said, to hell with you, we're not going to loan you money. These things are sinking like stones. And the head of Bear Stearns called back and said, I want you to just pause for a minute and think about this, gentlemen. You also have to mark to market. You are holding much of the same paper that we're holding. If you don't loan us the money, we will go under because we have to mark to market. But the next day, you will have to mark your own balance sheet to market as well, too. Within 48 hours, the loans were turned over to Bear Stearns and it stayed alive for another 6 months. So there is an entire world of hedge funds out there with probably $2 to $3 trillion in them that are not in a lot different shape than the commercial banks that have been folding up around us. And they're sitting on a lot of the same kind of securitized paper that really doesn't have market value right now or has only a wisp of market value. However, hedge funds are not regulated by the SEC or the Fed in ways that investment banks or commercial banks are, and so there has been no public marking to market of their asset pool. If we were to force transparency on them in the process of shoring up the hedge fund market, they would have to mark to market, and a lot of them would shut down with even greater losses than some of the banks that have shut down already, and that's why the federal government is not actually trying to get its regulatory hands around the hedge funds in order to make them transparent. They'd much rather have them stay in the shadows while they try to stabilize the commercial sectors that are under federal regulation rather than fill up the emergency room with yet more patients.
So in terms of I heard the figure of $62 trillion of credit default swaps out there. You're just saying, let's just hope.
Are you talking about 62 trillion? This is the this is the notional value of the paper.
Sure.
Yeah, don't worry. That's not that's transactional value. I wouldn't worry about that.
But whatever the figure is, you're saying
big. It's more than you and I make.
Right. But we should just sort of put that on the back burner so are we talking about an alternative universe here? Because a lot of the critics of what's happening now say none of this. And particularly in Congress, they've been saying this. None of this addresses what's really challenging the United States economy now, which is the lack of credit in the consumer economy, which is 2/3 of our economy, and that's dead in the water.
Well, again, there are two things. There are several things that are going on in there. If what you're saying is there's a separate recession getting underway based on one, a severe lack of consumer confidence. In the future prospects of the economy, which in turn is causing consumers to tighten up and not spend. Absolutely right. We know that. That's clear. How to get that started again is one part of the puzzle of getting this big machine moving that Obama is going to inherit and that Geithner has been tasked to work on from his perch at the New York Fed before he becomes Treasury Secretary. And I am sure that now that Larry Summers is NEC chair designate, he will be spending a lot of time talking with Geithner in a semi-official capacity about this. Yes, there's a separate issue. Now, whether the credit markets are freezing up, the credit markets did freeze up. They started to unloose, and they then started to freeze again last week when panic set in, and then the naming of Geithner seemed to unfreeze equity markets again, which may turn out to start to help unfreeze credit markets a little bit this coming week when the markets are open again. But have we still got credit problems? Yeah, absolutely we have credit problems. And the problems are that all lending institutions are terrified of the possibility that there is no interest rate that they can charge that will protect them from the likelihood of default on the part of a borrower.
Well, just in the last 5 minutes here, Dr. Richard Parker, can we talk about your notion of a new deal? And also, I was interested in reading about that conservative Mormon businessman, Mariner Eccles, who played an unheralded but important role in the interregnum in between Roosevelt's election in 1932 and his coming to the White House in January of 1933.
Let me do second first, and then we'll come back to New Deal. Mariner Eccles was the son of a polygamous Mormon father, the one of, I think, 22 or 23 children from four wives of this fellow. The father died when Eccles was a teenager. Eccles and his brother took over the father's several businesses, and by the time Eccles was 21, he was a millionaire. And this was a millionaire before World War I, when being a millionaire actually counted for something. And he went on to build the largest multi-state banking company in the Intermountain West, between the Bank of America out there in California and the big Manhattan banks at the time. His bank holding company was the largest interstate banking operation. He showed up at a set of congressional hearings on what needed to be done, and followed a group of New York bankers who gave all the conventional wisdom, which was tighten credit, raise interest rates, accept unemployment rising, liquidate, 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 in the words of Andrew Mellon, who was Hoover's Secretary of the Treasury. And Eccles basically said, you're fools. He said, you have got to instead have the Fed and the federal government pump liquidity into the system and use that liquidity and public spending to kickstart an economy that has clearly stalled out. Now, what he was saying turns out to be the on-the-ground practical policy application of what 3 years later would be published in theoretical form as John Maynard Keynes's Great General Theory. But this was before Keynes had published and was done without Keynes's brilliant mathematical economic reasoning, but rather from the practical experience of a banker who had a banker and a businessman, because he also owned several other non-bank companies, who had thought through himself how to solve this crisis of the Depression. Roosevelt turned out to be so impressed that he made Eccles first Undersecretary of the Treasury, and then 2 years later made him Chairman of the Federal Reserve. And Eccles then served for almost 20 years as Chairman of the Federal Reserve, a term as long, almost as long as Greenspan's. And it's in fact the case that the Federal Reserve headquarters in Washington is in the Eccles building, and witness to how important an influence he was to the Federal Reserve system and to the world of American public finance. Now, that then takes me back to this New Deal idea. I've been focused most recently just on how to re-regulate finance, because at the core of what needs to be done is something akin to what needed to be done in the 1920s, because the same rough things happened in the 1920s, which was you got a huge run-up in consumer spending based on expanded consumer credit. And this was basically in two forms, consumer credit to purchase goods like automobiles, refrigerator, other consumer durables. And then second, expansion of mortgage markets as mortgage terms were made looser and looser over the course of the 20s, and people jumped in because property values were rising through the 20s. It should sound familiar to any of your listeners, because it sounds very much like today. And what I think we need to do is not at all different from what was done in the 1930s to rectify the to deal with the disaster that arose from the collapse that followed that over-rapid expansion, which is in the field of regulation, we need to restore Glass-Steagall, which means we need to resegregate investment banks from commercial banks, from insurance companies, from brokerage companies. Deregulation that took place just 10 years ago allowed these different types of firms with very different interests and very different business models to purchase one another, so that large pools of funds that commercial banks and insurance companies had coming from depositors or premium payers became the basis for lending to the absolutely reckless kinds of financial instruments such as securitized subprime mortgages that are at the proximate first starting point for this most recent financial collapse. So segregate the industries, resegregate the industries institutionally. The second is that we need to regulate functionally. That is, the commercial banks historically have been regulated by the Fed, but over the course of the last 20 years, things like subprime lenders, credit card companies, and the like emerged to perform bank-like functions, but we're outside the regulation of the Fed. We need functional regulation. That is, if they do things like other institutions, if they do things like banks, they should be regulated by public banking regulatory authorities. The third is that in the field of equities, the SEC needs to either enforce some of its own rules or return to some of its own rules very quickly. A simple, somewhat esoteric example is the damage that is being done even as we speak by so-called short sellers. That is, people who sell short a stock in anticipation that the value will fall. There used to be rules that were put in place as a result of the Great Depression that limited short selling. And I actually happen to be a Calvinist on this one. I think short selling should be made illegal. What's striking to me is that even people like Jim Cramer, this, you know, yelling TV character who, you know, is constantly pushing the market, just this last week was calling for the punishment of naked short selling and the restoration of the uptick rule, which are too esoteric to go into right now. But it's a sign that when Jim Cramer and I agree broadly on the same direction, that there ought to be something there for the public to discuss in a serious way, because that's consensus that you wouldn't otherwise normally expect to see.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, because there's obviously a lot more to talk about, but I'm vaguely reassured by what you've told us here today, Dr. Richard Parker.
Thank you very much, Ian. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Dr. Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he's also a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's also a macroeconomist and a former political advisor to George McGovern, Edward Kennedy, and John Glenn. And last week, Dr. Parker chaired a forum at Harvard's Institute of Politics with the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, entitled Financial Reregulation in the Economics and the Politics. And now we're talking about piracy on the high seas and the country that hosts these pirates with Dr. Sayed Sheikh Samatar, who's Professor of African History at Rutgers University. He's also the editor-in-chief of the independent journal Horn of Africa, and he's published 40 articles and 6 books on Somalia, including Somalia, A Nation in Turmoil, and he's currently working on a project titled The Somali Collapse, Its Causes, Consequences, and Context. So, obviously, from the title of your new book, Dr. Sayed Sheikh Samatar, you're talking about a country that's in collapse, but it appears to have collapsed several times. So in terms of this term that's used nowadays, failed state, how can you kind of clarify Somalia's state in terms of the failed state notion?
Well, just that, no state. This is a place that has no central government since the last military regime collapsed in 1991. And since then, you have got factions, warlords, piracy, freelance looters all over the place.
So it's just a little bit of history. Back in 91, of course, the UN intervened because the warlords were making it impossible to distribute the charitable aid from the world that was appalled by the mass starvation that was going on. And then that then evolved into a U.S. occupation after a number of Pakistani U.N. troops were killed. And then that devolved into the famous Black Hawk Down incident, where a number of U.S. Rangers were killed and their bodies dragged through the street. That prompted President Clinton to throw up his arms and get out. And then President Bush came along and decided, apparently, there was a way to fix this situation by creating a proxy army next door in Ethiopia, which the U.S. secretly trained and funded to invade, to stabilize Somalia, and also to get rid of the al-Qaeda influences. And that seems to have backfired, has it not?
Absolutely. I said at the time and continue to say loudly that the Ethiopian American-backed Ethiopian intervention was an absolutely tragic move. The reason is, when the Islamists took control of Mogadishu, the capital, and the surrounding territories in southern Somalia, the 6 months they ruled between June and December, when the Ethiopians invaded, they imposed on the Somalis a barbarous medieval time type of Islamic regime, where they banned music, soccer games, to watching television, and even executed some people for not observing the 5 daily prayers. The Islamists were about to be discredited in the eyes of Somali people. And then this Ethiopian intervention came as a manna from heaven to give them a new prestige. Because the Somalis, when the Ethiopians invaded, the Somalis began to band around the Islamist cause. Hence, you have these Shabab people who are causing mayhem in Somalia now.
Yeah, of course, the most hideous example of that was recently, where a young 13 or 15-year-old girl had gone to the Islamist authorities to complain that she'd been raped by 3 men in her town. And instead of arresting the 3 men, they took this young woman into the town square and had her publicly stoned.
Absolutely. That was obscene. I mean, how low can you get? That gives you an idea of the barbaric nature of these so-called Islamists. They are not practicing Islam, which in its classical age has been a very liberal, humane religion, and they turned it into a barbarous, hideous thing.
So what connections are there, if any, Dr. Sayed Sheikh Samatar, with the this Islamist movement who are being pushed down into the south on the Kenyan border between Kenya and Mogadishu? And they there's some rumors, although I'm not sure how reliable they are, that they're in some ways in league with the pirates. However, I understand that there was also a statement from, I don't know which Islamist faction, objecting to the fact that a Saudi Arabian tanker had been taken because of Saudi's connection to the holy sites of Mecca and Medina.
I think by seizing a Saudi oil tanker, they have shot themselves in the foot. I think that is the final blow, perhaps, that would lead to their destruction, because much of the Islamist money comes from religious centers in Saudi Arabia. But if I may draw up a wild and distant parallel, piracy in this region has a long history. You may recall that the first American naval action took place when President Thomas Jefferson sent an American naval squadron because American merchant ships were being plundered on the Barbary Coast. And the Barbary Coast is not too far from the Red Sea and the Indian Coast. So the place has a long history of piracy. Now, this Somali piracy movement, without supporting them or defending them, began actually as a self-defense initiative. When the government collapsed about two decades ago, our long 2,000-mile beaches, pristine beaches, have been descended upon by foreign interlopers, fishing trawlers that from Russia, from Taiwan, from Japan, that descended on our beaches and hauled off our fish and shrimp. So the thing more tragic than that even is that the Italian mafia, and perhaps in collusion with the Russian mafia, began to dump nuclear waste materials on our once pristine and now unprotected beaches, so that the Somali coast is poisoned now. So the Somali pirate movement began as a self-defense initiative, but then when they realized that a great deal of money could be, ransom money could be had, then they turned it into a wholesale pirate movement.
So I guess the question here, who are the real pirates, the out-of-work fishermen who found a new way to make money, or the Russian and Italian mafia dumping nuclear waste on the shores of this country?
Could you repeat that?
I said, it leads you to ask the question, who are the real pirates?
Yes, that is a good point. In fact, you know, it is tragic because the country, with its meager resources, the sea coast and its maritime life is about one of our few resources. And now all that is poisoned. Livestock is, Somalia relies on livestock. Livestock's dying. The women are miscarrying. It is a disaster.
Well, that's an extraordinary. I've heard this story, but I haven't seen any real in-depth reporting on it. Can you give our listeners any links that they can go to?
They had if you can get into the website of the conference that was held in Djibouti last January, a Somali scientist gave a long paper on the subject. I can't quite give you the address because I don't have it offhand, but I think if you browse the internet, you can find the Djibouti conference and the paper that was on that subject of the dumping of nuclear waste on the Somali coast.
Again, I'm speaking here with Dr. Said Sheikh Samatar, who's a professor of African history at Rutgers University, the editor-in-chief of the independent journal Horn of Africa. He's got a new book coming out, The Somali Collapse, Its Causes, Consequences, and Context. Now, in terms of what to do about the pirates and these ports out of which they operate, apparently, you probably know that there's a lot of warships have been arriving in that neighborhood, and the Indian Navy did sink what they called a pirate mothership the other day. But there's also a Ukrainian freighter that's anchored there in one of these ports on the Somali coast that has a cargo of weaponry, Russian tanks, and ammunition, and I believe a lot of artillery as well, which a lot of people are concerned about. The Russians have suggested that the navies of the world should start bombarding these ports. The Europeans are saying, no, wait a minute. Where does it stand now in terms of what response is likely to happen?
Well, 2 points on that. First of all, you made a reference to the Ukrainian ship loaded with tanks and other heavy artillery, apparently destined for the southern Sudan, and that has caused an international uproar and a scandal because the Sudan is supposed to be under UN arms embargo, and here some governments are apparently shipping arms by the shipload. The other thing I have often said is that this is a vast area, Indian Ocean together with the Red Sea coast. I do not think, no matter how many ships you bring to bear on the theater, I do not believe they would be effective enough to stop piracy. What would be in my forthcoming book, I have a chapter entitled An Easy Way to Snuff Out Somali Piracy, and that is to use Somali methods. Now, what are the Somali methods? That is collective punishment. These people who are hijacking the ships belong to two clan families, the Hawi on the southern side and the Majerton on the northern side. What the international community needs to do, Somalis do not understand the Western notion of individual guilt and individual innocence. What they know is group guilt and group innocence. The international collective punishment, that is, the international community should go to the clan leaders of these pirates and tell them, look, if your people rob our ships, we are going to come and seize your livestock, bombard your houses, and take most of your men and women into captivity. Now, that's a rough kind of justice, but that's how it works in Somalia.
Well, who's going to do that, though? So, I mean, if foreigners do it, that's an admission that Somalia is ungovernable.
It is. It is ungovernable.
Uh-huh.
And the Russians, instead of threatening to bombard the port, they should come, send a few helicopters, and seize the clan leaders of these two clans and tell them, look, we keep these people hostage. If you move against us, we're going to take them somewhere else or even threaten to eliminate them. I can almost be certain that this will stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Collective punishment, in other words.
But I'm almost certain that it's not going to happen.
Well, if that's not going to happen, then you will have piracy.
I see. So, in fact, then what's more likely is they're likely to strike out, irrationally and fire shells from their ships and not... I mean, obviously, your methods are much more intelligent, but we don't have any examples that the Western powers have necessarily acted either with intelligence or with any kind of coordination.
Yes, well, fire shells from their ships, then what? The shells would fall on the sand dunes, maybe kill a few camels. They're not going to catch the pirates or stem the tide of piracy. The thing to do is, as you mentioned, have intelligence, human assets, intelligence on the ground, find out who the Somali system works by lineage, by blood descent. Mm-hmm. Find out who these people are, who their relatives are, who their clan leaders are, and then seize them.
Well, just in the last minute here, Dr. Syed Sheikh Samatar, just give us a sense of whether or not there's a long-term solution to bringing this failed state back. There aren't too many examples in recent history of failed states coming back, except perhaps you could argue it happened in Lebanon after their long civil war. But do you have any thoughts on that?
As a matter of fact, I have a chapter on that too, and the chapter, interestingly, is entitled A Fool's Errand. The international effort for the last two decades to restore a centralized Somali state, I call that a fool's errand, because Somalis have no history of a state system. What they need to do is, since the country has broken up into many regional states based on clan on clan relations, they should support Somaliland, Puntland, the Hiran region, have these states, many states, organize themselves into something stable. Once they stabilize the region, then gradually they should try to create some sort of federal system to attempt to impose upfront a centralized state. Is a counterproductive effort. It will not work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dr. Syed Sheikh Samatar.
Sure, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Syed Sheikh Samatar, a professor of African history at Rutgers University and the editor-in-chief of the independent journal Horn of Africa. He has a new book coming out, The Somali Collapse, Its Causes, Consequences, and Context. And, of course, we're talking about Somalia as the host country for this rash of piracy that's taking place along its Indian Ocean and Red Sea coastline. I'm now speaking with Dr. William Boone, who is a political science professor and dean of graduate studies at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia, where he's a recognized expert on the politics of the state of Georgia, where there's a special election to take place on December the 2nd between the incumbent Senator Saxe Chambliss, the Republican, and Jim Martin, the Democratic challenger. In the last election, there was a 3-point difference, with Chambliss being 3 points ahead, and the independent Libertarian candidate got 3 points. So, in effect, they were even. I guess the first question then, given how important this seat is to the Democrats, with the possibility of reaching the 60 threshold in the Senate, Philip Foster-Pooth supermajority, what's going to happen to those 3% that Libertarians, as far as I know, Dr. William Boone, there aren't too many African-American Libertarians, at least I haven't met too many.
Well, there are not that many who have declared themselves as such that we've known of.
So does that put Jim Martin at a 3-point disadvantage?
Not necessarily, because Mr. Buckley, who was a Libertarian candidate for that for the Senate seat, has decided not to endorse either candidate, which is interesting because early on in the campaign, during the campaign, he had indicated possibly that he would go with Martin, but apparently changed his mind. And there's a strong possibility that they may stay home. They may indeed not participate in this this runoff at all, and that actually could cut badly for Chambliss, in my view, because after all, these people tend more towards the Republican philosophy than they do the Democratic one. Although the last batch of Democrats in the White House have not been to their liking. And Chambliss has been rather problematic for them as well.
So, and of course, we all remember Chambliss's election against the war hero, who never served in the military, managed to swift boat Max Cleland, triple amputee from Vietnam, likened him to Osama bin Laden and question his credentials in national security. From what I understand, Shambliss's only credentials in national security is that he's a reliable flak for the military-industrial complex and the big contractors down there in Atlanta.
Yeah, without a doubt. That's been his bread and butter, quite frankly, to keep that kind of largesse running this way and to make sure that it would not discontinue. In fact, you know, actually, it's interesting that the Georgia senators have always been the ones who have been rather cozy with the military in terms of military spending in the area, because it has been the military spending that has sustained a portion of the Georgia economy for a number of years. Russell, George, all of them have been connected with that on the Armed Services Committee. Probably the only break with that to some extent, not extensively, was the one who preceded Shambliss in the job.
You mean Max Cleland?
No, before Max Cleland.
You mean Sam Nunn?
Sam Nunn, yes. Although Sam Nunn was strongly military, he was a bit more rational, it seems,
than
the other ones.
Yeah, he wasn't a total pork barrel guy.
Right, not at all. But you're absolutely right. And to go back to your description of the election between Shambliss and Max Cleland, it has been characterized by some as probably one of the dirtiest campaigns around.
Well, it was characterized by John McCain that way.
Yeah, early on. It's interesting, too, and because McCain, as you know, is a strong military supporter. At least he positioned himself as such, but he came down several weeks ago and campaigned on behalf of Shambliss, so it's rather interesting. And when I think that speaks to also the kind of importance that Republicans and others place in this particular race.
Well, apparently the argument that the Republicans are putting forth in the state of Georgia, and of course you've got McCain visited, as you mentioned, to rally support for Shambliss, as did the other GOP presidential hopeful Mike Huckabee, and Rudy Giuliani is apparently going down there next week, and in support of Jim Martin, former President Bill Clinton was in Atlanta on Wednesday, and former Vice President Al Gore is down there
today,
Sunday. So obviously the parties understand the significance and importance of this race.
Yeah, they really do. I think Shambliss has portrayed or sort of postured as a kind of race to act as a break on any kind of runaway liberalism that may manifest itself in the Congress at any time.
Right. They're arguing now that you have to elect Shambliss in order to make the Republicans effective as for the checks and balances.
Well,
I was going to say that's a new argument for the Republicans, right?
Right, yes, it is. You know, they sort of flip, a turnaround, 180 degrees on them. But, you know, it is interesting, too, because it's running somewhat counter to other factions in the Republican Party who are talking at this point, at least publicly, about some sort of cooperation on those areas where they can be cooperative. And Shambliss here is campaigning very, very strenuously on the fact that he acts as a firewall against this runaway liberalism, Pelosi, Reid, and Obama, and he throws Martin in that camp as well.
Right. And he's also throwing out in his ads the specter of socialism and all of this crazy stuff that Sarah Palin put out.
Yeah, right. As a matter of fact, he's adopted a good many of the McCain-Palin themes, one of which is the fact now that he's portraying Martin as too risky for Georgians. And also, he's tying Martin. And it's very interesting because he, although not as dirty as the other campaigners say, but certainly he's tying Martin to the crime issue and portraying Martin as one who would not be prepared to protect Georgia's children, Georgia's women. And
even though Martin had his own daughter kidnapped at one point.
Right, yeah. Yeah, absolutely correct. That was my next point. And he's trying to portray him as rather soft on crime. Along, of course, with the economy, on the question of taxes, but it tells you, I think, it speaks volumes about the depths to which this campaign is sunk.
Well, how's that likely to translate, though, in terms of the numbers that show up on December 2nd? Now we know from this last election that Sarah Palin really did activate the Republican base, and that's pretty much I imagine the people down there in Georgia that that came out to vote were inspired by, for the Republicans, were inspired probably by her more than by McCain, although I don't necessarily know whether I'm right on that.
Well, I think you're going in the right direction. The data, you know, we're looking at data now, but it doesn't necessarily point to that, but it certainly points to the fact that she was able to draw out the core. And you, if you remember early on in this in the presidential race, there was always this question in the minds of folk whether or not those core voters, especially in Georgia and across the South in particular, those ones who were on the far right wing or the right wing of the Republican Party, would even show up at all. And so that's why you tried out Palin on a couple of occasions. So now we get the same kind of strategy being used by the Shamless people to try to get people back to the polls. Because folk in this area are notoriously not poll returners. They will not necessarily come out for the second round. Now, folk who have come out, of course, that would have been Republicans, they have come out traditionally for the second round. African Americans have not necessarily turned out. But I think this is a different kind of political season we're going through, and a good many of the measures that we have used, those of us who are political scientists, have been somewhat thrown aside, and we have to sort of recalibrate. So whether or not they turn again is a good question. You have Obama's people on the ground here in Georgia for Martin, as you probably are aware of, and I think that's going to be a real test for them. Can they once again rally the folk without Barack Obama's physical presence here and without the excitement around the first African-American nominee and the first possibility of African-American becoming president, well, then they can do that and bring these folks back to the polls.
Right, and I understand that excitement did exist on November the 4th, and but one of the paradoxes, I understand, was that with this record, the large African-American turnout for Obama, that it didn't necessarily translate into down-ticket voting for
right.
Jim Martin.
Absolutely correct. And that's very good, because as we were sitting there watching the returns come in, we were looking at the difference between not only for Martin, but also for Shamless in terms of the number of votes the top of the ticket got and the drop-off between Shamless and the top of the ticket. And the same thing, of course, for Martin. So the excitement of that election was interesting, because the down-ticket voting was rather bad. Did not turn out well for either of these people.
If you're a Republican, I mean a Democratic strategist, how do you revive those people and get them to do what they didn't do last time and get them to come back? And conversely, if you're a Republican strategist, what are they doing in terms of for Shamless? And
well, Republican strategists are trying everything. Well, let's start with the Democrats first. The Democrats have a very tough job, because they have to certainly get out not only the African-American vote, but also the vote of people between 18 and 29 who helped to get that 47% of the vote for Barack Obama here in the state, and especially in the metropolitan Atlanta area, to get that vote out, because there's not much hope down in the southern part of the state. But certainly in the middle of the state and metropolitan Atlanta, there's a bit more hope. So they really have to get out the vote. And by that, I mean they're going to have to mount a campaign in the same fashion they mounted one a GOTV campaign, the same way they did for Barack Obama. They have to provide transportation. They have to mobilize preachers. They have to mobilize civic groups just to get the vote out. Now, for the Republicans, of course, what they're going to have to do is simply raise the specter of the fact that you're going to have a very, very liberal Congress out there and get their core people out. And the core people are the folk who have been and continue to be the ones who go to the polls in the runoff season, during the runoff. So and they have to keep bringing out the fact that you have already a Congress that's pretty much controlled by Democrats, and you have Barack Obama as president. You don't want to give him full sway.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, we wait with bated breath, Dr. William Boone.
We do as well.
I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. You're speaking there with Dr. William Boone, who's a political science professor and dean of graduate studies at Clark Atlanta University in Atlanta, Georgia. We're talking about this cliffhanger race that's coming up, which could decide whether or not the Democrats have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.